OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball.
Are you crazy?
This is OTB Sports Radio.
Are you a complete rookie? What are you talking about? Are you out of your mind? Are you crazy?
Absolutely brilliant maneuver by Mansell. Fantastically brilliant.
It's been a hell of a life and a career, yeah. Thank you for giving me this platform to announce my retirement.
Wexford lead 2:13-2:8.
The treatment was tough. You were given every encouragement and every chance to survive.
When I was 13, 14, I was playing on about 13, 14 teams at the time.
OTB Gold, the very best of off the ball. Weekdays from 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
OTB Sports Radio, live 24/7 on the Go Loud app.
The Off the Ball Podcast Network. The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now you're very welcome back to Off the Ball this Sunday. Neil Tracy with you until 6 o'clock. Time to turn our attention to the Sunday Papers, where we are streaming across YouTube, offtheball.com, Twitter, Facebook and all of our social channels as well. And joining me this afternoon, I have a former Dublin footballer and now coach, Cliona O'Connor, as well as former Irish basketball captain and now basketball commentator, Timmy McCarthy, joining us on Skype this afternoon. Guys, thanks a million for joining us. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here, guys, and looking forward to it.
Cliona, you were one of our first guests when we started trialling these Sunday paper reviews over Skype. A couple of teething problems on that first week. I remember Tommy Martin was on with us as well that day. He got a notable interruption. We had him back on last week, though, and he had the room to himself. But this is becoming the norm now. We're getting well used to this. It was all very, very new about, 8 or 10 weeks ago when you were last on with us.
Yeah, it has changed a lot, and I guess all of us as coaches, and we're spending more time online, and there's dogs and there's kids and there's grannies and aunties coming into rooms for people all over the country, which is, it's good fun, isn't it? It's a bit of real life sometimes is no harm.
It is, yeah, and we're all getting used to it. And Timmy, how have you been finding things? I know you were speaking with Off the Ball not long ago. You spoke with Will O'Callaghan around the time when The Last Dance first came on our screens. I know you were very interested in it as well. So you've been mentioning you were using Zoom quite a bit around that time as well.
Yeah, Neil, I use a lot of my business. I'm in my business consultancy. I teach people how to actually communicate over Zoom and video conferencing. So I have always found this as a medium that people should get more comfortable with and more adept at. So for me, the last 10 weeks personally has been awful from being locked down, but professionally has just been the same as if I was in the room facing them one to one.
That's very good to know now. We'll mark that down, because one of the challenges we have had over the last little while is that, look, there are a lot of people who aren't that familiar with Skype or Zoom or getting on these video calls. Now that we know there's someone like yourself out there, Timmy, who's well used to it, we'll mark you down and we'll be coming back to you a little bit more.
Yeah, thanks, Neil.
You can give us all lessons in it. So I'll run through the back pages very, very quickly here before we get into it. And a lot of the coverage really today is on both the resumption of football in the UK and sport in the UK, as well as when the pitches are going to open around the GA grounds in the country. But this is the back page of the Sunday Independent. Wait is over as UK returns to action. Green light from government sees racing first back, beginning with action tomorrow, while they also gave the go-ahead for the Premier League to resume on June the 17th. And down at the bottom as well, no fairy tale ending to Armstrong nightmare. Paul Kimmage is writing a couple of pieces actually today about Lance Armstrong and I suppose the dealings he would have had with him down throughout the years. Lance Armstrong's documentary has been running since last week on ESPN. I think there's another episode of it coming out tonight. We'll bring you an interview, obviously, at 4 o'clock with Tyler Hamilton, one of Armstrong's former teammates, on that matter as well. He was speaking to Juran Owen after the first episode of that documentary came out last week. So that's going to be at 4 o'clock. Then back page of the Sunday Times, if I try move it around, get it into the picture there. Plan for new season in August. 12-week transfer window. Government signs off sport return. So the Sunday Times are reporting that the new Premier League season next season will resume in August. So it's going to be quite a short little turnaround from when the planned finish for this season is up at the end of July in the FA Cup final on the 1st of August before a quick turnaround into the new campaign, which looks set to be getting underway on time. The star this Sunday Wembley, Klopp's Liverpool to claim title at National Stadium, 20,000 fans in ground to see FA Cup final. So they have a couple of stories here which we went through with Steve-O in the news round and Enda as well. So the first one is that the FA could lead the way with fans returning to football in the FA Cup final at Wembley on the 1st of August. It's believed plans are being explored to allow up to 10,000 fans from each side to support their teams in the final, but that will only happen if the infection rate drops below 0.5. And then over on the right side of the page here, Liverpool look set to claim the Premier League title at Wembley, with the National Stadium being lined up as the neutral venue for their games against Everton and Man City. So as we know, any game involving Liverpool is being marked down as a potential red flag by police, where they want it moved to a neutral venue. But as I say, there are conflicting reports on this, because the back page of the Mail goes with Liverpool as well. Home rule: Liverpool cleared for title glory on Merseyside. So Ian Herbert and Rob Draper are reporting this. They say the UK government has paved the way for Liverpool securing the Premier League title on Merseyside by insisting that a decision on neutral venues lay with a local authority group based in the city. So they are saying that the decision on whether or not games will be played at home or away venues or at neutral venues is going to be left up to local police forces to decide, and it seems Mersey police are okay with the idea of Liverpool playing their games at Anfield, even if they are going to be title deciders. So conflicting reports there. Liverpool also on the back page, but this is of the Sunday World, but this is transfer news. So it's Timo time for Klopp. Liverpool must act fast to get red-hot Werner. Liverpool are ready to make the move to sign RB Leipzig striker Timo Werner, but the Anfield club are still arguing over the €60 million release clause to sign their top target. And Pat Spillane there in the bottom banner there. Spillane, the GA must act fast to protect its future. That's following on from what Pat Spillane was saying last week, which we discussed in detail about opening the gates on the Irish Sun this Sunday. Opening up a final can of worms on a debate we haven't had in a while. Splitting headache. Ex-chief Leinster Senior Football Championship needs Dublin divide. So the former GA presidential candidate Martin Skelly says Dublin should be split, or else the Leinster Senior Football Championship is doomed to remain a procession. That is one that we haven't really heard in a while now, the split Dublin debate, but I suppose while we are in lockdown, we have a lot to think about and a lot of time to put these things together. And then up at the top, nice one Tyson. Anthony Joshua would not fight his hero Mike Tyson because the crowd would boo him. I'm not really sure why that is on the back page, really. And then on the Mirror, they go with, put this date in your diary, August 1st, fans back. So the Mirror are also running with the news that we had in the Star, where up to 10,000 fans from either side could support their team in the FA Cup final. And up at the top as well, Cop Wembley date. So Wembley is emerging as the likely venue for Liverpool's Merseyside derby with Everton and their clash with Man City. So the Mirror and the Star are obviously getting the same sources on both of those stories. So, guys, that is the back pages. We will kick off, I think, this afternoon with something that has probably been dominating the sports pages over the last couple of weeks, and the debate over how much of the GAA grounds should open, when should the GAA grounds reopen, when should players be allowed to start going for a social puck around or start training competitively. So we have a couple of pieces worth talking about today, and which is quite nice. They are actually presenting different sides of the argument. The first one we'll probably open up here is on page 2 of the Sunday Independent sports section. John Green saying clubs hold key to confidence, and that the GAA doesn't need to apply a one-size-fits-all approach to GAA grounds reopening, but that they do need to look at certain places where there aren't really amenities, and how in Dublin they don't necessarily have to open up the grounds because there are huge amounts of park spaces and other places where people can get their exercise, but that it probably is something that is needed around rural parts in the country. And also then on page 71 of the Mail on Sunday, Shane McGrath writing, science will reopen our pitches, not whinging. And essentially that people do have to be patient with whether or not clubs can reopen again. So this is one where we're going to start off this afternoon, guys. Conflicting opinions.
Yeah, definitely conflicting opinions, but I don't think you can ignore either of them, Neil. John's Green piece, he's really pushing the status of the GAA and how it kind of sets the tone in Irish society and all that type of stuff, which is true. And that's why their approach to date, I think, has been what it is and has been very measured and very cautious, because we needed to be measured and cautious. And I guess one of his big points is, he says here, a big part of the recovery will have to be about spreading confidence in society again, showing not just by word but by deed that it's time to move on. So there is that sense of, you know, we want to move on. We need to trust each other. You know, communities need to look after themselves and that. But that's all well and good when it all works well. But the GAA is a national organization. So they, in some ways, I think they do have to save us from ourselves a little bit, because we're all eager to get out. Like, I'm dying to be out in a GAA pitch and playing or training or coaching or whatever. And I think the enthusiasm, maybe if the gates were just to open, off you go, would challenge people just to keep themselves in check a little bit. So I still think it has to be measured, whereas maybe there is a time to, I suppose, be a little bit more or make some changes to the current restrictions. But I think that cautious, measured approach is still needed as we progress out of lockdown, I think.
For me, Neil, I think that Shane McGrath's piece is very interesting, because he talks about science. We're living in abnormal circumstances, and what's happening right now, as the lockdown is getting released, we're trying to revert to normality, and that's really a conflict. You can't have normality in abnormal circumstances, and sport for all of us is the biggest loss. You know, for all of us who love watching sport and for those of us who play sport, that's the biggest loss. And particularly the GA, which is our national sport. And this time of the year, with the weather being so fine, we all, you know, say it'd be great to go to a match this afternoon, or it'd be great to go to a club match or an inter-county match. But the reality is this virus has not gone away. And I think one of the risks that we face is that we're putting a huge amount of pressure on the GA. I mean, you know, Pat Spillane last week and others, Colin Murrough has been advocating it, and a lot of, you know, significant, you know, key people in the GA family and fraternity have been talking about that this should be reopened. I think Shane McGrath is right. I think it's a scientific issue. You know, I disagree with John Green saying that, you know, Leitrim should be allowed open and Sligo, you know, because, as Cliona said, it's a national organisation. So what about the people in Dublin? You know, so they have to make national decisions. You can't have an organisation which, you know, says, well, we're really a national organisation, but when the pressure comes under us, you know, we'd make, you know, sort of different decisions. And I think that the challenge for the GAA is to have the courage to stay with the scientific measured approach. Now, it's not easy. You know, one is that I think is the big question is, you know, will they play a championship in 2021 or 2020? And forget what's happening in professional sports and the Bundesliga and the Premiership, because that's about money. That's about TV money and contracts. So, you know, it's not the same agenda here. What we have in Ireland is a pure sport played by phenomenal sports people, men and women. And we've got to make sure that when they play it, there's no risk to either of them. There's no risk to anybody involved in the game, and there's no risk to the families of anybody who's participated, whether it be stewards, referees, players, selectors, or whatever in that sense. So I'm more on the Shane McGrath side that science should dictate this. And, you know, there's a big question mark at the moment in Ireland about the 2 metres and the 1 metre social distancing. You know, right now it's 2 metres. We should just follow the rules of 2 metres.
Yeah, I think with the 2 metres thing, what I've kind of found is that, you know, 2 metres is what they're saying. A lot of people haven't necessarily been abiding by 2 metres. So if you reduce it to one, then you need to take into account the fact that there are a lot of people who probably aren't going to follow it. So you probably need to make it maybe a little bit stricter than it has to be. Cliona, what sides of the fence are you kind of falling on regarding open them up, leave them closed until it's absolutely safe to do so?
I think I'd be a little bit with Timmy here, is that, you know, my world is sport. I'm not a scientist. I'm not in the medical profession. The GAA have significant advisory committees on this, and they should follow science, you know. And maybe because we are a, relatively speaking, a kind of a small organization where everyone knows each other. We all know someone in a kind of influential position in the GAA, and so we all talk and all that. So that sort of grassroots pressure can be quite forceful in the GAA. And of course, we all want to get out. But I do think this is one time that we have to listen to medical experts, and we have to be guided by that, not local sentiment. And I guess as grassroots players and members, we've got to trust the GAA to do the right thing, because opening them just for the sake of opening them isn't a sensible thing to do. Mm-hmm. That's where I'd be at. Just follow the science.
Neil, can I just develop that point a little bit?
Yeah,
I think one of the things right now is that, you know, in abnormal circumstances, leadership is really important. And leadership will have to be courageous to deal with grassroots pressure. Because if you, your point about 2 meters to 1 meter, you know, if you give us an inch, we'll go take a foot. You know,
yeah,
we're just
exactly.
we want to just get the best out of it. And I really think what is needed right now is clarity. And the big thing I think for GA people, I mean, like Clean, who are coaches and people who play and are involved in GA, there's no exit gate. We don't know when the exit gate is happening. So that makes it more uncertain, which puts more pressure. So therefore, we get more restless and we start putting pressure on our clubs, and then we push up the line in the GA fraternity. I really believe that the GA need to make a decision as regards what's happening with the club scene in 2020. And make a firm decision based on the science. And if that is cancel everything, well, then it's cancel everything. And the same with the intercounty. And then, you know, because at least if you had a clarity on it, then people would stop having, you know, sidebar conversations, which end up with, you know, national headlines in different papers this week and last week, and TV and media reports about we should reopen, you know, forget everything and reopen. So I think the GA have to be really, you know, clear in their messaging. And right now, to be fair to them, they're saying we're following the science. I think the next step they have to do, they have to make a call on whether club or county or both are scrapped for 2020 and play all those championships at the start of 2021, get rid of the league in early 21 and play two All-Ireland championships, which happened before. You know, you players with different counties in the 20s played one All-Ireland 1 year with one county, and in the same year won it with different counties. So that has happened before. But they do need clarity for the people like Cliona, the players and the fans. Mm-hmm.
Is the happy medium probably what the GA are actually planning to do now, whereas in some cases where they have them, the walking track around the pitch is going to be allowed open, which is obviously going to be a huge resource for clubs in rural parts of the country?
Well, if I just take that point, I mean, the 5 kilometre rule is very interesting at the moment because, you know, golf clubs are open. So I play golf and golf clubs are open. And, you know, I would have to be honest and say, my view is the 5 kilometre rule is not being obeyed in golf clubs. Mm-hmm. I would say that. And I think that's, you know, so because we won't do it, we're mad to play golf. We're mad to be volunteer. So if you allow the walking and you say, well, you've got to keep 2 metres of social distance, we're creatures of habit, and under pressure we do what comes naturally, so we naturally evolve closer to people and talking to people because we want social interaction. So I think the opening really irrelevant in my view as regards the GA. The question for the GA is, when do you start allowing people train and then basically train properly and ultimately play? That's the big question. And I think my guidance to them would be, make the call on it so that people know when the exit gate is happening. And then people will follow. If your leaders set the vision, people tend to follow.
Yeah, there was a good debate on this actually a few weeks ago. We had Shane Keegan on, and himself and Joe were kind of fleshing out the debate of, you could possibly allow teams to come back in some kind of a training guise. Like, what is necessarily wrong with allowing a puck around, or, you know, just kicking passes to each other from 20, 30 yards? Because one of the big arguments that's being made is the mental health side of things, that people just need to be able to get out, nice summer evening, you know, the hard ground, kicking a ball around the place. And in theory, you can do all that while keeping 20 metres away from each other, let alone 2 metres. But, you know, do you actually have to have the contact training? Do you have to have matches? Do you have to have, you know, hard training sessions to be able to enjoy it? What's wrong with just going out and, you know, having the kick around?
I suppose it's an interesting one, and there is definitely a bit of, we are sports people, we are competitive, and that idea of saving us from ourselves, because give an inch and take a mile. So everybody's going to be, when as this starts kicking back into gear and people are training again, everyone's going to be trying to play catch up and all of that. So you're trying to get the most out of it. So if the restrictions are quite clear, then there's no wiggle room. But if there's grey areas, then all of a sudden what you're supposed to be, you're supposed to be 2 metres, you're a metre, or you're supposed to be groups of four, it's a group of six. There's all these little bits and pieces, which some people won't mind, other people get very stressed out about. So you're actually creating opportunities for conflict in some ways, I think. The other thing, a totally different, I suppose, take on it, some that I've noticed as a coach, this period has really empowered players because, okay, we're team sport athletes or team sport players. We like being in the group. As a coach, you think you're wonderful and you have to be in the center of everything and you know, they can't survive without you. But I've learned in the last 10, 12 weeks, they can survive without you. Maybe they need a bit of guidance, but I've seen my local GAA team here. I drive by a public pitch and I see them out on their own, doing their running, doing all sorts of stuff, really taking ownership of their own training, developing their own skills without me having to motivate them. So there's still an opportunity for players to train and for players to develop, even in the current climate, which as a coach, you kind of have to be humble sometimes and realize they can do a lot more. I don't have to be standing over them all the time. That there's plenty that can be done right now.
We've a couple of minutes before we have to take an ad break. But quickly on that one, Cliona, do you think, like, from the coaching point of view, that what we're all going through right now and when we actually do come back, are players going to start enjoying the game a little bit more, making a point of actually enjoying it rather than getting stressed out about the win-loss element?
Well, I think they're players, so they're always going to be competitive, and they'll definitely always be ambitious for the win. But I do think they realise what they're missing. So even for me, from coaching, like, I realise what I get out of a team training session now, what it brings you, and I know the players feel the same. So they love the training, the physical training. Yes, I'm getting fitter, I'm getting faster, but the bit they miss is those sessions 3 or 4 times a week when you're with like-minded people. So I think we will, I suppose, savour those trainings a lot more when we get back to them.
Mm-hmm. I remember when you were first on with us, you were talking about the tidbits of information you were trying to get out to the players about, like, you know, the various ways of training you can do at home, whether it was, like, you know, lifting paint cans or something like that.
Yeah.
How have you found that develop over the last 10 weeks? Have people just got used to it?
People have got used to it and they've made the most of it. And you've definitely, and I think I said it time I was on before, that you realise the simplicity of training sometimes. I had a guy send me videos or a picture of his garden, and he chopped down a tree, and he'd before lockdown or whatever, but he had these logs and he'd stood on a weighing scale with the log in his hand, so he'd figured out, well, this one's 15 kg and this one's 17.5, and he'd written on a marker and they were his weights, and that's just as good as holding a dumbbell. But there's a bit of, for players, I think when they figure out a way and they overcome the little challenges, that they get confidence from that. You know, feck it, I've figured out how to do it. And they feel good about that then.
Yeah, I weeded the garden there about 4 weeks ago. It was as good as training as I've had in years. Time for a quick ad break and we'll take news as well. First, I'll just text in here on 53106. This is not about intercounty, it's about young people's health, where they call to each other's houses to play together. Science will say no contact sport until we have a vaccine. Our young people will become unhealthy over the next 2 to 7 years. That's from Niall. But there has been evidence to show that, you know, people, young and old, all around the country have probably been exercising more than they ever have been over the last 8 or 10 weeks. But that's it on the, I suppose, GA reopening, will it or will it not, and the opinions otherwise. More coming up on the Sunday pay-per-view with Cliona O'Connor and with Timmy McCarthy as well. But first, though, we're just going to take news headlines.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, you're very welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review. Neil Tracy here with you until 6 o'clock this evening. We are in the company for the paper review of former Dublin footballer and current coach Cliona O'Connor, as well as former Irish basketball captain and current commentator Timmy McCarthy. A text in here on 53106 in response to our conversation about GAA grounds reopening. This is a very interesting text. It says, very interesting conversation regarding the GAA and a possible return. Just on a contrary note, I've been involved in my club as a player and coach for 40 years, often to the detriment of family life. One thing I've become really aware of is the amount of time I actually have now for family and home life. The shutdown has made me realise how crazy I have been. I'll finish off my duties and actually won't be going back in 2021. I can imagine others will feel the same as well. Guys, I can imagine this texter probably isn't the only person who's probably used the last 10 weeks or 12 weeks to actually really reevaluate the things they do in life on a day-to-day basis.
And Neil, just to pick up his point, I think that a lot of people will evaluate what has gone on in the last 12 weeks. But you asked Clean a point earlier on, you know, will players just enjoy the game when they get back, or will it just get back to winning and losing? You know, in the start, people will enjoy it. And in the start, people will say, I won't maybe give it as much time. But over time, we'll just go back to doing what we always did. And the people who gave it a lot of time will start giving a lot of time again. And the players will focus on their performance. And if they're focusing on that, that gives them win or losses as it goes out. So the start of it will be very interesting. You know, it'll be nice and cuddly. And you know, but as the reality hits in, it'll just go back to what we always do. We're creatures of habits. And as we change our habits, we just go back to doing what we always do.
Yeah, and I think I was even thinking along the lines of work as well, when things like the Premier League comes back and we start to have more regular sport, I was thinking for the last little while that, God, the first few weeks back when we're doing our shows and there's loads of Premier League to talk about, and into August as well when we have a few rugby games and stuff, God, like the average day and the average week and the average show is actually just going to seem so easy. But as you're saying, probably within 3 or 4 weeks, you get into the routine of that, and what was easy becomes the difficult week all of a sudden.
And think about when you go on holidays. You go away for 2 weeks somewhere and you come back to work and you say, oh my God, I'm back on Monday into the office, or in Cleaner's case, back in the coaching fields. And you say to yourself, oh, I'd love to be back wherever I was on Monday. But I'll ease myself in. And by lunchtime Monday, it's as if you'd never won holidays. The world just goes back to normality.
Right, guys, where will we go next? We have a long list of items that we have lined up this afternoon. Who wants to call it?
I'd love to talk with the red cards. I think that's, to me, a really great piece by Dermot Crowe.
So this is Dermot Crowe in Sunday Independent as well, pages 2 and 3. And he's speaking about, it's actually quite an interesting one, people who've been sent off in All-Ireland finals. So specifically, he is speaking to Eamon Scallon of Wexford, who was sent off in the 1996 All-Ireland hurling final, which Wexford won. And then Tony Davis, who was sent off in the, I think it's in 1992 All-Ireland football semi, or All-Ireland football final for Cork against Derry, which Cork lost, and how it's something that stays with them for years, particularly in Scallon's case, even though they won. He says it's like it's something that he is constantly reminded of. And Dermot, he paints the picture well of the sending off. He says, it goes beyond the short walk from the privileged area inside the white lines to the space occupied by the great majority outside. The moment of sudden transition from being a player to being no longer a part of the biggest game in your life. It carries on after the followers have gone back to the action and maybe cursed your impetuosity. And far beyond the game too, won or lost. Depending on who you are and how events happened, it might be with you for the rest of your life. Scallon never started another match for Wexford and still carries that sending off with him like a cross.
So for me, I think it must be the worst thing that could happen to any player. But I think the consequences are very different when you win and lose. Okay, so in the 93 game against Derry, right, for Tony Davis, and as a Cork man, I can remember being there and watching it. I was devastated because, first of all, I know Tony Davis, and you know that was never his type of style in that sense. Secondly, they rescinded the red card post the game. So, you know, it was actually worse in his case, because in Eamon Scanlon's case, the view was that, you know, he was unlucky to get a red card, but it was a red card. In Tony Davis's case, they rescinded the red card after, said it shouldn't have been a red card, and Cork lost the game. At least in Eamon Scanlon's case, Wexford won, and he didn't have to live with the what if I had remained on the field or not, would we have won that, you know, especially in the 96 game, because Wexford hadn't won for so long, 28 years or whatever. So, you know, so the issue is different whether you win or lose. There's no questions, I believe, that Liam McHale is a good friend of mine, was sent off against Mead. You know, Mead win the game, it's a very different issue than if you're sent off and your team win. But personally, and I've always believed this as a player when I was playing, and it's different when you're a coach because you want the players to be a team and all of them come together. But as an individual player, you want to perform well first. And players will say afterwards, and always about the team, your first challenge individually and your first thought is, did I perform to the best of my ability? And then did I win? And anybody who says that, in my experience, the reverse way around, did we win and did I perform, are probably telling a few porkies. Because the reality is, as individual players, we want to perform. If you're sent off in an All-Ireland final, it must be heartbreaking. If your team wins, it buffers it a little, but you still feel awful. As Eamon Scanlon said, he's never left the core. Tony Davis's argument that Dermot Crowe made, he had won club titles And it sort of buffered it from, I don't believe it did. He was sent off incorrectly, even though Tommy Howard afterwards said in the piece on next to Dermot Crosby's a side piece saying that he never lost a night's sleep about any decision. I think that's actually really a very interesting comment for me, Neil, because he made a wrong decision. And I think if you make a wrong decision at the highest stage, you've got to feel, you know, I've made a wrong decision.
But I don't know. I think, is that something that a referee, is that a hazard of the job, that you need to be able to, you need to be able to make a mistake sometimes and just park it and, you know, not let it affect you the next time you're out there?
Oh, I get that point, Neil. I spoke at a referee's conference many years ago and I said, I don't believe a referee can be consistent from game to game. I really don't, okay? I think that it's just not possible because games are different, players are different, teams are different. But I do believe a referee has to be consistent from the start of the game to the end of the game. And even though I'm speaking against one of my Corkonians, Niall Callaghan should have been sent off in that game long before Tony Davis was involved in his situation. The referee didn't make the big call then and then, you know, made a call after. So I don't believe they should carry him from game to game. But I do believe if they make the wrong call, they should admit they made the wrong call and not be glib in saying, I never lost a night's sleep about it.
Clean, have you ever been sent off, final or no final?
I haven't. I mean, yeah, yellow maybe, but no, send it off. Jeez, Timmy, I think you're carrying it more than Tony Davis is now.
Yeah, but cleaner we lost. I mean, for Cork people to lose is a real issue, you know?
Yeah. I really like this piece, actually. Is a real insight into that individual versus team thing. Like, the bit I got from Eamon Scanlon of what he was saying was that he didn't do his job for the team. Mm-hmm. And that was his big thing. He didn't do his job. And, like, it's heartbreaking. He's saying, but even though they won. But for me, looking at it, I felt completely detached. It didn't offer anything. I almost cost a lot of loyal servants to Wexford their chance of winning in All-Ireland. And still to this day, while I have my medal and all that, it doesn't feel like I won it, if you know what I mean. And he talks about going back coaching Wexford underage to try and make up, to try and give back, even though they won. So it just shows the weight or the longevity of the effect, I suppose, that it has on an individual.
Yeah, and that was one thing I found interesting, kind of like what you were saying, Timmy, as well, that, you know, Eamon Scanlon, Wexford did go on to win even without him, and, you know, how if you're in that case, it shouldn't really be something that is living with you forever. But in his case, if you were to just read the quotes and not actually know anything about that game, you probably would actually think Wexford had gone on to lose, because he still has the guilt to this day, not even about costing his teammates a victory, but just this long-running guilt of, I could have costed my teammates. And, you know, he's talking about the fact that you had guys like George O'Connor, who'd been there for so many years, and these great servants to Wexford, that, you know, his moment of madness ultimately could have actually ended their dreams. And he's just really good talking about the thought process going through his game. And he's kind of saying that, you know, a lot of people would say maybe it probably wasn't a red card offence, but he understands that the game was developing to a point in terms of dirtiness where the referee probably did have to make an example of someone. And unfortunately for him, he was the straw that broke the camel's back in that case. But as you're saying, like, you know, the bigger picture is that it almost ruined it for the likes of George O'Connor, Billy Byrne, guys like that, and for the supporters as well. And he's talking about at halftime when Liam Griffin regrouped the troops, and he's saying, when they're a man down, the simple message from Liam Griffin, pure hurling and no fouling.
I mean, for me, I can understand Eamon Scanlon's view. I mean, I was in my last year, we were national champions in basketball, and we got to a cup, and basketball was played over one weekend back then, Neil and Cliona. And I had a really nice game on the start, and I scored a lot of points in the semi-final, and we got to the final. But I broke a blood vessel in my right thigh on the start of the night. Now, I had my cruciate injury at that point in time, and a month before I'd injured my ankle. So my right foot was completely immobilised. I played in the cup final unfit, and we lost by a point. And to this day, I regret playing in that cup final. Now, others might say the coach should not have played you. I decided to play, and I was unfit. I scored my lowest ever total in any basketball game I've ever played in that, because I played unfit. 6 weeks later, I came back out of fitness, fully fit, and played against the same team, and we beat them very comfortably. So I can understand how, you know, 30 years on, Eamon Scanlon would still, you know, be really sad about, or 24 years on in his case, be really sad about what happened to him in regards to his teammates at that point. So, you know, it doesn't go away. You know, you live with these you live with the successes and you live with the heartbreak of the things that don't work for you. And that's just the reality of sport. That's why we love it. And that's why we all play and participate in it.
So when you made that decision, did you know at the time that you were making probably the wrong decision and you were just kind of being a bit bullish about it? Or were you hell-bent on, no, I'll be fine, I think I'm fit to play, and you're trying to convince everyone else around you?
Okay, so first of all, I made a decision as a player. So I emotionally was playing really well. So, you know, I believe that, you know, I could perform. But the reality is I was limping. I limped the whole game. So what I needed at that point in time was the coach to say to me, when I became a coach, this is what happened, Neil. When I was a coach, I tested players. They were fit or not fit. If they were fit, they played. If they weren't fit, they didn't. But as a player, I made a choice, and all players want to play. We all want to play because we just want to play. So I made a wrong decision personally. You know, my wife would say, well, the coach should never have to play, but that's my wife's undivided support. I made a wrong decision, and I made it because I was emotionally in the wrong place because I really wanted to win this title because it was, you know, because we were the best team at that point in time, and, you know, it was a shock we lost it. But we lost it, in my view, because I played unfit.
Kleena, I know you're saying you've never been sent off or anything. Do you ever have those similar kind of regrets, though, about days where you look back and there was something you did that is kind of still living with you for a long time?
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. My very first All-Ireland final, we played Mayo. We lost by a point, but they scored a goal in the last minute of the game. A high ball came into the square, and, you know, I've watched it 101 times since, but it actually drove me to master catching a high ball, because I was like, I should have absolutely gone for that ball and cleared it. I didn't even have to catch it. All I had to do was get out of the square. But that first All-Ireland final in my first year with Dublin informed a lot of how I prepared for games ever since. So if you're a competitive sports person, and we all try and take, you know, they say nothing is a failure if you learn from it. And so we're always looking for something to learn. What can we take for it, even when we don't win and whatever? But those things stay with you, definitely. I think nearly every competitive sports person has a story or an issue like that. I played when I shouldn't, or this happened and I should have been better or whatever. Because we're competitive and we want to win. Mm-hmm.
Obviously.
And Neil, just on that point, when I became a coach, that was, to take Kleena's point, I learned the lesson. Don't let the player make the decision. It's not the right decision for the player to be asked to make, because the player just wants to play. Okay, so if there's an injury question mark, as the coach, make the decision. And that's tough because, you know, it could be one of your better players that you have to say you're not playing. But it's always the right decision.
It is interesting, obviously, naturally, the issue of Richie Hogan's red card in the All-Ireland Hurling Final last year comes up, and Eamon Scallon kind of speaks about it, and it's quite funny because Richie Hogan loses an All-Ireland Final and gets sent off in it, but like Eamon, it's incredible just to see how much this is, he's keeping this burden on himself, because he's saying, like, in his case, his situation was actually even worse. Even though they actually won it. So he was saying at last year's All-Ireland Final, where Richie Hogan was sent off like he had been shortly before half-time, unlike in Scallon's case, Hogan didn't have the consolation of his team winning. See Richie, says Scallon, and I don't mean to lessen what he experienced, but Kilkenny have won a hell of a lot more All-Irelands than Wexford have. Wexford were up there for the first time since 1977 and haven't been back since. The occasion was really big for Wexford at the time, and that's why my indiscretion, could have been far, far greater than Richie's was. And I'm sure if you spoke to Richie Hogan, he'd feel the very same way about getting sent off as I did. You feel you've let everybody down. You feel isolated. You have no interest in hurling. You start thinking about yourself.
And I think that's a very honest appraisal. You know, it's a long walk. I mean, you think about it. It's a long walk across the pitch. You have fans, you know, who are criticising you, even if they feel you've been unfairly sent off. They're still criticising you for being sent off. You know, you have your teammates look at you and saying, well, can we win this with only 40 men? What has he or she, you know, what have they done to us in that sense? In those split moments, even though they understand it when in the cold light of day. And it's very difficult. And, you know, as I said at the start of this piece, Neil, is that it's the context of the sending off makes a difference. So in Richie Hogan's case and Tony Davis' case, you know, they lost. And that makes it different, I believe. In Eamon Scallon's case, Wexford won. And then it's just his individual emotions of dealing with, you know, the disappointment and the hurt that he caused himself. He believed he caused his teammates and the public. That stays with you. And it's you know, and maybe if he'd gone back to play for Wexford, and it doesn't say why he didn't play for Wexford now after that. It doesn't tell us that story. But maybe if he played on, you take Clina's story, which is a brilliant story. You know, that first All-Ireland final, you know, she looks back and said, I could have done better in that situation. But she went on to win, you know, after that. So it all depends on how you react as well to the difficulties of what you have just faced.
Certainly it is. And Clina, I think one of the more gripping parts of it is where he's actually just describing sitting there watching the rest of the game. So he says, I remember nothing from the second half. My whole system just shut down once I got sent off. People asked me that question a week after the game and it was the same. You were just there. You were looking at this match. What would it be like? It would be like going to an interview for a job that you're dead sure you are getting and then next thing you don't. It's like a match you're playing that you're dead sure of winning and next minute you don't. I just feel there was nothing I could do. So it's this sense of helplessness sitting there when you've been preparing so long to do everything you can for the team.
Yeah, you're out there getting ready to, or you're preparing to do your job, and by the sounds of it, that Wexford team had very clear understandings of tactics and roles and all of that. So they knew what they were trying to achieve. And all of a sudden, you're in the stands, and there's nothing you can do. And you're as good as a spectator. You know, you can't be brought on again or whatever. And like it's fascinating his perception. And you probably, if you ask the rest of the players on their team, they're not going to talk about his sending off. They're going to talk about the fact they won the All Ireland. So he's probably the only one that's carrying this burden with him. You'd be looking at someone like that who's clearly a committed GAA person, and you're sort of saying, let yourself off the hook. You know, these things happen, and it was the description of the incident. You know, it wasn't a malicious tackle or anything like that. It was one of these things that happen in the game, and you didn't cost anybody anything, so it's okay. You know.
Mm-hmm. And I think one of the lighter notes as well that I enjoyed, one of you mentioned undivided support a little while ago, but this line, Scallon met Pat Horan in Croke Park in recent years and had a perfectly civil drink, a few drinks after a match. No mention was made of 96. That first night when Wexford celebrated their Ireland win was almost 24 years ago. Scallon's mother made a beeline for Horan at the post-match banquet and emptied some of her frustrations, but mothers are rarely impartial.
Love it. Like, you can see it happening.
Oh, you can picture it.
Where are you? Yeah, my son.
Yeah. And in that moment, okay, all she's concerned about is her son. Wexford have won, you know, they're all celebrations, but her son has been dumped on. And in her mind, and obviously, and I think Clina's point again, you know, the fact that players look back, if you'd asked any of those Wexford, you know, panel, they just say we won the All-Ireland.
Yeah.
They don't pick up moments, you know, of, you know, I did this. I mean, maybe Tom Dempsey might talk about a goal he got, but in general, they won the All-Ireland.
Yeah.
I think that the mother story is actually, I think that's a brilliant story. I just thought to myself, whoa. You know, but look, you know, my own mother sadly has passed on, God rest her soul. But I, you know, all our mothers would do that for us. You know, they see us as the best of all, and it doesn't matter whether we are or not, they see us as the best, and that's what matters for them.
Yeah. While I'm on that note, actually, I think I might throw out as well, it's my own mother's birthday today. So, ma'am, happy birthday. I hope you're listening at home. We've been missing a trip down to Limerick for quite some time. It's January since I was last back in Limerick, so hopefully in the next couple of months I'll get down. And also as well, another birthday at home, my little niece Emily. She was one on Friday as well, so a couple of big birthdays in the Tracy house. So I said I'd get those out of the way and put them in as well. So no, it is just a very funny image of, I would say, the embarrassment of being sent off in an All-Ireland final, briefly being taken over by the fact that your mother has decided to go up and berate the referee on your behalf.
Yeah.
It is one of those moments you can actually just, as you say, Neil, visualise Eamon Scanlon, you know, feeling awful, because even though they've won, he's still feeling he's feeling it 24 years on. So obviously when it was more raw, you can imagine how tough he must have felt on himself. And then, you know, you just picture the scene, you know, his mother gets up from her chair. Okay, she pushes the people out of the way. She makes a beeline for the referee, and then she gives him her view of the world. And for those few seconds, nothing else in Eamon Scanlon's mind is, oh my God, what is my mom doing to me? Because he's forgotten being sent off. He's just worried about, you know, what is his mother doing? at that point. But you know what? I'd be proud of her for that, you know, because she stood up for her son. That's a great thing, a great sign of her, you know.
Yeah, I'd say that's one time where a referee certainly will have lost sleep over a red card he gave out in a game. Right, that was Dermot Crowe, page 2 and 3 of the Sunday Independent. Cliona, I might pass the baton over to you now. Where will we go next?
Maybe John Green in the Olympics, maybe.
Yeah, so we mentioned John Green a little bit earlier on as well. So saying the Sunday Independent, actually some very interesting stuff in it. But John Green, editor or sports editor of the Sunday Independent, he's talking about just how Olympic athletes in Ireland are starting to suffer as a result of the regulations that are in place at the moment. We would have seen on the show yesterday even, John Duggan had an interview with Sunita Pospur where she was talking about how if she isn't able to get out and start training again pretty soon, she's going to have to start considering retiring because she's just not going to be able to get up to Olympic standard, and how there's probably an imbalance with countries around the world where, you know, some countries, athletes are going to be able to go about their daily business and train as normal. In other countries like Ireland, and probably in a lot of other places as well, where there is still going to be a lot of time before they can get back out. And as you were saying, Cliona, you were drawing comparisons to GA players and, you know, the idea of opportunities being lost.
Yeah, and it's, I suppose everybody in Ireland is the same state of mind nearly, you know, small business owners are thinking, when can I get going again? Because there's a feeling of we're starting to emerge. So for Olympic athletes, the Olympics is their business and their bodies and their training is what they do. So they're like everyone else trying to figure out, okay, how can I get back on track? And especially it's challenging for them because at least in GAA, everybody's under the same conditions in Ireland now. But these guys are going to be competing against the entire world who are training under very different circumstances. And Sarah Keane, the article, makes a point about the Irish rowers. She's talking about the 5K limit and saying that for some of the Irish rowers, they may be competing against each other for a place in a boat. And right now, if I'm within 5K of my river, I can train, but somebody who I might be competing against can't because they're 20k away. So was just describing the imbalances, and I suppose asking for exemptions. And you can understand it. You can understand it from their preparation, the fact that every day is a training day. But it all sits in, I suppose, the national state where the message has been social solidarity. We're in it together. So the idea of exemptions will always cause what about me? You know, why can't I go and start my thing and they can start their thing? You know, so exemptions are hard to actually action, I think, when we're talking about communal and social solidarity. But you can 100% see the point and see where they're going to lose ground. They definitely will.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting as well because, like Timmy, a lot of the athletes in question here, they're going to be, they're individual competitors. They're not part of a team process where, you know, you have the idea that one of them's going to be out there slowly, it might be two or three and then four, five, six, and in the end you have a whole team training together. For the most part, these people are looking to train by themselves.
Well, there's a couple of points in the article that really stood out for me. The 5 kilometre points stood out that Cliona talked about. But some of these people haven't qualified yet. I mean, that's one of the big risks for these people. And obviously, some have qualified. So, you know, like, they're individuals, so they do a lot of their training on their own. But they also have coaches who, fine-tune the technical aspects of each individual sport that these people are competing in. The issue I see for them will be, first of all, will they get the qualifying time? But I think the bigger issue will be, if the Olympics is on in 2021, as currently as planned, and we stay, you know, on a scientific road that's going to have us behind the curveball of other countries. Doesn't mean the other countries are right or wrong now. It just means that we've decided, you know, to take, you know, to be on this journey. It means that when they get to compete in Tokyo next year, they'll be behind the curveball. No matter what they do, they'll be behind the curveball. And then we'll be questioning why we send him, because we won't have as many medals or any medals, depending on the circumstances. And that becomes more pressure. But I think that, you know, the point Cliona made is very valid. You cannot make exemptions. You know, I was listening to the news where we were on break there, a professor came out talking against the risk. And South Korea went back into lockdown last night because they opened it out and all of a sudden the virus returned more aggressively. So we've got to be very careful. This is sport, guys. people are losing their lives. Healthcare people are putting their lives on the line. This is just sport. And for all of us who love sport, I happened to play in two pre-Olympics in the 80s. So I know what this is about, the effort you have to put to get to international level. But the reality is that until we fix this issue, we have to be able to take it on the chin that the abnormal world we're in from a point of view of training for Olympic Games, training for anything else, but in this case the Olympians, will have to remain until we can create a safer environment for the public. Because at the end of the day, humanity is more important with respect to all of us, and I love sport, than any sport. The human, you know, if you said to me, Neil or Cliona, you know, having the Olympics is worth one person's life, I'd say it's not. I'd say scrap the Olympics for 4 years. It's not worth anybody's life. And we have an issue publicly with a virus that we need to deal with.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the other side of it is we're all trying to do the best we can and try and keep some sense of, and I know your point, Timmy, about it is abnormal times, but it's human nature to try and to make things normal and to figure it out and to keep going, and not for someone, if you have given years and years and years to your sport or and the same, the absolute same thing can be applied to if you're running a small business down the road and you've been doing it for 20 years and you're trying to keep it, figure out, okay, how can I keep this going in this environment? It's the same stuff, the same motivations, and you can understand why they want to do it. And Sarah Keane again makes another great point about with in relation to performance athletes, they can't afford to get sick. So of all the people, they're going to want to keep themselves as healthy as possible, everyone around them as healthy as possible. This is not a group who are going to take any risks with any of those protocols. This is a group who are going to rigidly adhere to them. So there is that side of the argument as well.
And just to make that point on that argument, the big issue for some of these athletes, this is their peak. You know, this Olympic Games is their peak. So in 4 years' time, they could be beyond their peak. And, you know, so this is the moment that they've been building for a long time in their case and in their cases. And this is their moment. And it could be sadly taken away from them. So I understand that. And from a small business point of view, you know, I get all that. But I'm just saying is that, you know, we're looking for normality. I mean, one thing I do hope we're doing with all athletes, irrespective of any sport, is that we show our care for them. We'd ring them and ask them how they're getting on. How are they looking after themselves? Are they minding themselves? Because that's very important through this process. Because if you're an elite athlete, be it in GA or be it in this case as an Olympian, you're focused and on getting to the best out of you when the opportunity arises. And right now, that's a hard situation to sustain. So I just hope that coaches all around the country in every sport are spending a little time every day in the care of the people that they coach, in the care of the mental health of people and their mindfulness, and just that, rather than checking out, well, have you done the 25 push-ups or the 25 sprints you're supposed to do?
Mm-hmm. And it's worth pointing out, Sarah Keane is interviewed in this as well, as like they are pointing out, I think some of the frustration comes down to the fact that they just don't really have clarity, not so much they're not happy with the date they're being given, but they're just kind of unsure about what's happening. So as is quoted here, in the Northern Ireland Executive Roadmap, sport is in one of the titles, says Keane. In our roadmap, it's not. It's culture and society. There's references to outdoor recreation and sport. There are references to some of the contact sports, maybe the bigger field sports, but there's nothing referencing their sports specifically. So from our athletes' perspective, there's no time frame around it at all. So I think is the frustration maybe just coming from the uncertainty as opposed to the fact that they're not out there today?
Well, I think uncertainty is a massive problem for any sports person. It's one of the things we're all really struggling about. And if you're trying to create a high performance structure, it's all about this is what we're going to do, this is when we're going to do it, these are our hoped results, this is how we'll review it. But now we're all living in an environment where, well, this might happen in 3 weeks, it might happen in two, we have to see how we go. The Olympics, they're down to happen. Will they happen? We're not sure. So there's so much fogginess around everything, which is, like, athletes hate that. Any sports person hates that because they want to know, well, what am I dealing with? And I think you're right, Neil. If there was a little bit more clarity on it, then at least you know what you can do. But it is what it is, because the nature of this exit plan and this roadmap is that we go through this phase, we see how it goes, and then we progress to the next one. If all goes well, we progress to the next one. So we're in a scenario where Irish society and the reopening of it is dealing with a, and it lets, we have to see how it goes, ethos, let's say. So that's a massive challenge for planning ahead, which is what sports people do. They love planning ahead.
I have sympathy, Neil, for them, because they're looking at other countries then. Mm. And they're looking at what's happening in the UK, and, you know, what Boris Johnson's doing. And, you know, they're looking at what's happening in Germany. They're looking at what's happening in America and a whole lot of other countries. And there's no consistency. So if you're a rower down in Skibbereen and you're saying, well, I can't go, you know, 6 kilometres to practice because that's the rule in Ireland, yet my counterpart in Switzerland can travel 100 kilometres, that must be very frustrating. So I have huge sympathy for all the other Olympians and potential Olympians, but we're in just a tough time, and it's just, you know, and as I said in the Jay's conversation earlier on, if we had an exit date, if we knew where the gate was, this would become a bit easier for us. It would still be hard, but it would become easier. But we don't have an exit date, and now what we're concerned about, because some countries who had opened up their systems seem to be now considering locking them down again, and it just is all this uncertainty, confusion. And if you're an elite athlete preparing for Olympic Games, that confusion is really a big challenge, because you're trying to peak your body for a moment. You're trying to peak your body for July, August of in this case, 2021, where you had already tried to peak it for, you know, July and August of 2020. It's really tough on them. So I have huge sympathy for all of these athletes. And, you know, I thought as well in the piece they talked about, you know, the national sports campus. Is that something that they should consider, you know, creating a space for people to practice? But again, people have to travel to and from. So it's not there's nothing easy in this for any athlete, particularly the Olympic athlete who's trying to qualify or who has qualified and trying to get ready to peak. But that's, you know, that's the hand we're dealt with at the moment, and we just have to deal with it as best we can. And again, I'm going to repeat the point. I really hope we're showing some care, because mentally and emotionally, this is a tough time for athletes in all sports. And I really hope coaches are spending a little bit of time every day checking in to see, you know, are you doing okay?
Yeah, certainly. That's where we'll leave it on the Olympics. I'm sure it's probably something we're going to be hearing about for a few more months as well coming up. Time for a quick break, though, and we'll be running through the last of the stories on the Sunday Paper Review with Clean O'Connor and Timmy McCarthy after the break.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, you're very welcome back to Off the Ball this Sunday. Neil Tracy with you until 6 o'clock. I'm in the company right now of Clean O'Connor and Timmy McCarthy, and we're looking through the Sunday papers. So still a few more stories to get through. First, though, a text in here on 53106. This is in relation to Dermot Crowe's piece in the Sunday Independent about red cards in All-Ireland finals and the mental torture that players deal with after going through that. This texter says, I think about a junior county final in which I missed a fairly handy goal chance to win it and missed. It sounds ridiculous, but I often think about what I'd have done differently. I actually can't imagine being sent off in an All-Ireland final. Psychologically, it could and does break a player. Clean O'Connor and Timmy McCarthy are with me here on the Sunday Paper Review. Guys, the next piece I think we'll go to is one that is actually on our own website, offtheball.com, this morning. Arthur O'Dea has been in conversation with the Irish athlete Gina Akpamoses. And it's quite interesting, and I think given the timing with actually what's going on in America over the last few days, I'm not sure, is it a pure coincidence that Arthur has been speaking to her this week, or was it something that had been planned for quite a while? But just to bring you the opening paragraph, Gina Akpamoses was born in Lagos, raised in Louth, and is now living in London. An accomplished Irish athlete on the world stage, she has consistently faced the following question: why is there a black girl on the Irish team? A pernicious attempt to ostracise Moses and query her Irish identity. It was only when she left Ireland that blackness became something she knew to celebrate. In conversation with Off the Ball, here's the story of how this change occurred. So Gina Akpamoses, she was born in Lagos, moved to Dundalk at an early age, and has been based in England for the last number of years, where she's training as well. Goes on to kind of say, I still get asked, why don't I go and run for the UK? I mean, I lived in Ireland for years, and it isn't like I just got a passport through some random family member. I've medalled for Ireland on the world stage. I get it. I'm part of Ireland. And talking about how she won't be surprised if her absence and living in England really only just makes some hearts grow even more weary and agitated, is the way Arthur describes it. It's a very, very interesting piece with Jean Akpamosis, and it probably does raise the difficult question of the issue of racism in Ireland. And as Gina says, she never personally experienced any overt kind of racism, but did kind of experience it was more milder forms of it, people looking at her a little bit differently as opposed to the overt actual form of racism itself.
I thought Neil this was a really interesting read, and probably a reminder to us about racism in Ireland. There's a really good piece in it, or a paragraph in it, when she says, race wasn't something I took much notice of in terms of prejudice when I was growing up, explains Moses, but I was naive. In Ireland, racism is hidden away just a little bit. It isn't as blatant as the UK or nearly as bad as it is in America, but in Ireland, people just try to present themselves as nice and hide those opinions away. They don't want to be thought of as bad people, which I think is... like, it's very interesting and powerful to hear her perspective on it, and maybe we have to acknowledge that. So in a country where we are, like, just because our heritage, we're very aware of where you are, who you are, where do you come from, all of that type of stuff, just because our nationalism and our past, I guess. So we're just aware of it. And we're not a historically multicultural country, so I think that's something we in Ireland we have to acknowledge and deal with, is that okay, there mightn't be any, as you say, the overt racism, but there's those sort of unconscious prejudice or assumptions, and we all have them, and if we pretend for a second that we don't, I think we're naive. And I know myself that, you know, you have noticed in Irish athletics over the last couple of years, and I can say you definitely do notice, oh, we have three young black athletes wearing the green bib, because Ireland is changing. But you notice it, and that's the reality of the situation. That's the reality of her situation and her life. And I'm sure as an athlete, she knows that the country notices it, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think for me, Neil, we should first of all say racism is wrong. There's no ifs or buts or maybes. It is wrong. And, you know, so she obviously, you know, has felt it in Ireland, and, you know, she obviously made a point about the UK. So racism is wrong. Secondly, she's an Irish athlete. She has run for Ireland. I made this point on your programme a number of months ago about Declan Rice. He played for Ireland. He now opted, you know, because of a rule to play for England. So, you know, she's no different, in my opinion, you know, as somebody who's captain this country, as Declan Rice. They played for Ireland underage, and she ran for Ireland underage. So she's an Irish athlete. I think the whole idea of, you know, of teasing out Cliona's point is, you know, is we're new to this. Like, when I played basketball in the 80s, there was American players. Most of them were predominantly black players. Many of them have stayed on and lived, you know, in Dublin and other parts of the country. And many of them went back to America. And there were some white players in the team. Back in the 80s, if you were a black person in Ireland, people believed you were a basketball player. You know, and that's not that long ago in the historical sense. So Ireland has only becoming to get used to become multiracial over the past, you know, sort of 20, 25 years, 30 years. So we're new at this. And the problem is that, you know, Cliona's point is a real great point. We have this habit of saying, where are you from? I knew your grandfather. I knew your father. You know, I knew your uncle. And in this case, we don't know somebody, you know, the immigrants that have come into the country, their grandfather, their fathers, or their aunts or uncles, that's it. So we're new to immigration. But the reality is that it's wrong. Racism in any form. You see what's happening in the States. It is completely wrong. Because what we should do is stand up for people who play for Ireland for the reasons she's or represent Ireland. Like, she's doing it from a point of view of the love of her sport. You know, she has no commercial reason to do this. She's not benefiting any commercially to run for Ireland, because if she was, she'd run for the UK. She would have a choice to run for the UK, and she could benefit more commercially. So I'm very impressed by the fact that she wants to run for Ireland. I'm very impressed by the fact that she has done so well for Ireland in the past. And, you know, the fact that her comment about the hidden aspect of racism is just the reality of our learning to deal with immigration. We're an emigrant country, and we had no issue emigrating people and expecting others to integrate them. We're still learning to immigrate people and bring them in, integrate them into our country. And that's not easy. You see a lot of programs over the last period of time about direct provision centres and, you know, local communities objecting in different environments in different parts of the country. So it's, you know, this is just a reflection of it. But I do believe this. She is an Irish athlete, and therefore we should do everything in this country to support her and recognise that she just is an Irish athlete. And the colour of her skin is irrelevant, in my opinion.
Yeah, I think there's a good point made. They referenced the fact that after she won gold at the European Under-20s a couple of years ago, it was people criticising her because she was holding the tricolour flag upside down behind her. So it was gold, white and green as opposed to green, white and gold. And she says it was all, oh, that's the Ivory Coast, not Ireland. Now, these people know I'm Irish, so why make the fuss? There are, I would imagine if I've won gold at a World or European Championships and I'm doing all my celebrations, someone throws a flag over me, I'm just throwing it up into the air. I'm not looking behind to make sure I have the green on the right side or working out which way is the camera looking at me so that I can adjust it for them as well. You're just throwing a flag up into the air. You're celebrating.
But you did, this is the ridiculous side of all of this, where people are just willing to pounce on everything. So that's an example. And the example where she's saying she's moved to the UK. Sure, we have Irish soccer players going over to the UK. We've, in athletics, you travel all over the world for good quality training. And it's an example of people that ready to pounce and say, oh, you know, she's moving to the UK, she's not an Irish athlete. Like, we should be absolutely proud that we have someone of that ability and caliber running in a green shirt, you know. And it's whether she moved to the UK for a few years or mistakenly held the flag the wrong way around, who cares?
And there are people, Neil, who will question whether, you know, people should have our national flag in sporting environments. Just, you know, there's people that always have views, and, you know, and obviously, you know, if you want to pick a point or something, it's very easy to pick a point. That's the easiest thing to do, you know, and particularly in the modern world where you can sit, you know, in your private environment and social media and pick any point you want. But the reality is that, you know, she has performed with pride for Ireland. She has, forget the fact she's won, that's actually a nice benefit, but she has performed with pride. She has given us her best. Okay, she's born in Lagos, but she's grew up in Dundalk and County Louth, and she's given our country the best she can do. And I just think that anybody who questions her, you know, is completely wrong. You know, I mean, there's no question mark in my view, I mean, that she is Irish in the sense of, you know, because as I said, she's doing it for all the purest reasons in that sense. And but the reality that we also have to face is that we have a hidden racism that we need to, you know, as we're learning to deal with immigration, we need to be strong enough to stamp it out and say, this is wrong. There's many of us this week watching the George Floyd tragedy and murder in the US, right? And then we're watching the riots and we're all forming different views on a whole lot of different things. The reality is that racism is wrong. But racism survives and thrives because we don't say it's wrong. And we are a new country in the form of immigration. We need to be saying more often and more repeatedly that racism is wrong, because we'll see more people who were born in other countries or who were born in this country to their parents from other countries who will be playing on our GA fields, who will be playing in our soccer teams, who will be playing in our athletics clubs and rowing clubs and basketball clubs. And we just have to understand they're Irish in the context of their nationality at this point in time. If they're running for Ireland, in my view, they're Irish. If they're rowing for Ireland, they're Irish. And it's not whether they win or not makes them Irish, is the fact they've decided to play for Ireland and row for Ireland and run for Ireland.
Mm-hmm. So that is Arthur O'Dea in conversation with Jean Ackpamoses on offtheball.com. That's where you can find it. Guys, we've pretty much completely run out of time. We have 2 minutes and counting left on the Sunday pay-per-view. So there's actually quite a lot that we didn't get round to today. Very quickly, if you want to just pick out a couple of pieces and tell people where they are and what you were going to point out for the rest of this show.
Tommy Conlon has one in the Sunday Indo about the soccer. And he just, he's a great line that he said, all footballers, great and useless, are equal under COVID-19. Everyone can hear you scream. I thought that was, it was a great, great line in that. And it's a, it just describes the soccer with no crowd and all about it. And I thought it was a good one. Nice, nice coverage of it.
Yeah, that was very good. And Timmy, very quickly, one last piece from yourself.
Yeah, the page 78 in the Mail, the Rob Howley story about the gambling.
Yeah.
You know, I just thought the tragedy of Rob Howley in the grief issue that he had with the loss of his sister Karen. I just thought that's worth a read. There's so many great quotes in it. I mean, first of all, it was €4,000 and 363 bets, not £4,000 in his case. But I just thought the tragedy of the fact that, you know, the impact of the loss of his sister. And I think for all of us, that really is one we should all read, because it's a sporting story, obviously, you know, going, being sent back from Japan to World Cup. But it's a human story. And I just think that there was great. I thought they did a great job interacting the humanity, the human story, and then the consequences in a professional sporting sense for Rob Howley.
Yeah, I think it goes back to that line that the best sports stories aren't necessarily about sports themselves, but about the people who are just happen to be involved in sports. Timmy McCarthy and Cliona O'Connor, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon on the Sunday Paper Review, and hope you enjoyed the rest of your bank holiday Sunday. Get out there and enjoy that sun. We're going to be sticking around for a few more hours, though, here on Off the Ball, because coming up next, we'll be speaking to former Republic of Ireland striker Stephen Elliott.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball. That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.